Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to a very special edition of the Life Enthusiast Co-op Online Radio Network, restoring vitality to you and to the planet, starring the founder of the Life Enthusiast Co-op, Martin Patella, and I'm your co-host, Scott Patton. Hey, Martin, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, but what have you been drinking?
Well, Martin, I've had a very interesting couple of weeks, and I've been down to Jamaica, and I have sat on the beach for 2 weeks. I actually do tan. I don't burn when I'm in a tropical environment under the sun. Well, I don't burn that badly compared to the way it is in the northern climates. I think there's a huge difference in the rays that get through because my girlfriend was like, "Oh, you tan nice." Yeah, but I don't really do that up in the north because I burn really nice up in the north. But when I came back, so I had flown to Fort Lauderdale and Fort Lauderdale to Jamaica, back to Fort Lauderdale, and some friends of mine living in Atlanta said, "You know, Scott, you got to come and visit us. We've got these great shirt shops and outlets and clothes," because we were talking about clothes, and then and it turned out that it was just as cheap for me to fly there, spend a couple days with them, and then fly home as to buy a ticket all the way. So that's what I did. And when I was there, he was listening to the sports talk radio. And, of course, I listen to, because of the talking and everything I do, I always like to listen to talk radio. And I listen to talk radio, and I also listen to sports talk radio. And in Canada, where I am, they talk
peacefully.
Peacefully and slow. But in Atlanta, Georgia, man, they're just talking a mile a minute. I can't believe it. They're all excited. Everything's going on. It's really, really fast. So I've got a little bit of that kind of still going on because I only got home last night.
And it seems as though they're drinking a whole bunch of some kind of juice.
Kickapoo Joy Juice is what they call it.
Oh.
Which is what Mountain Dew used to be called before it was called Mountain Dew. And Joy Juice. So I've had an interesting time being in a different environment with different folks and trying to understanding too that what people consider healthy in one area, like the West Coast, and what they think is healthy in the Southeast, and what they think is healthy in the Northeast, are very, very different things because chili burgers are considered really, really good for you in Atlanta, Georgia.
Please describe a chili burger. I don't know what that is.
Okay, white bread buns with a quarter pound ground beef with chili poured over it.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a chili burger.
Is there anything else, or is that the whole thing?
There might be a pickle put on top of the bun.
Oh, okay.
Good stuff.
So that is by all accounts nasty.
Yeah. So they took me there. I got off the airport. It's a place called the Varsity, mm-hmm. and it's right beside where the college football, because college football is huge in Georgia. Uh-huh. It's right beside the college football stadium. So they'll have 50,000 people there for a game. And, of course, everybody that goes to the game has to go to the Varsity. So this place, they're obnoxious and rude, and it's part of the charm. And if you go up and you haven't decided, they send you to the back of the line. Like, they just don't have time, right? It was really, really funny. Like, if you get up there and you go, nope.
Next.
You go to the back of the line. You don't come up here until you decide what it is you want, honey. We were happening to be there when there wasn't a football game, so it was a little bit quieter, and they were quite nice. But she was actually the people I was with were actually very surprised that usually they're ruder than that. Us Canadians, you know.
You had a foreigner look.
So. Had a foreigner look, yeah. But there was one thing I wanted to actually talk about before I forget. And normally we don't really sort of date. Our episodes, and this will definitely date it, but there was a very sad piece of news that happened late last night, early this morning, in that one of the founders of Apple, Steve Jobs, passed away.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. I was actually planning on bringing it as a theme into the into the podcast, into the conversation, because I have a whole bunch of opinions about it.
Well, I, you know, first of all, he's 56, and next week is my 55th birthday, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm thinking, you know, I'm going through my head. I'm not thinking, oh, God, I'm going to die because he died, right? But I'm, what I am thinking is, here's somebody that's worth a couple billion dollars or whatever, right?
Oh, definitely that kind of number, yes.
Yeah, well, and certainly well over, you know, multi-millions. In other words, money is not an issue.
He has uncountable wealth.
He can't spend it, right? So yeah. He could buy all the superfoods in the world and have it like 10 glasses a day, right?
Mm.
If he wanted to. And he wouldn't even spend as much as he spends on his car in a year, right?
Yes.
And there's all these things that he could have done. There's all these resources that he should have been able to have access to, which I suspect that he did not. And I thought also it's interesting because if you look at what it must take to build and run a multi-billion dollar company, one of the largest companies in the world, the stress level must be just right through the roof, even if kind of everything is going okay, right?
Well, let's chunk it down a bit, please.
Yeah.
I mean, let me say it this way. Have you noticed how Obama is changing in these last 2 or 3 years that he's in the office? There was not a gray hair on his head when he was sworn in, not that I could notice.
Right.
It's cutting in big time. And they're working him hard. He's probably at work 12 hours a day, and the other 4 hours that he's awake, he's probably thinking about work.
Yeah, I would say that you're being kind.
Right. So I relate to what you just said about Steve Jobs and how he must have really lived his job.
Yes.
And I'm here to tell you that I live my job, and yet I don't feel stressed most of the time because I just take it one breath at a time.
Right.
And I think that Steve actually was quite good at managing his priorities. I watched his Stanford University 2005 commencement speech that he gave there. It was a 15-minute thing. You can find it on YouTube if you want to see it. And it's a lovely speech. He mentioned three things that were important to him. And one of them was, don't take yourself too seriously and expect to die. Expect to die any day. Every day is a gift. And he was being quite philosophical then, because in 2005, when he was giving that speech, he had just recently been diagnosed with that pancreatic cancer that he did get, or that eventually killed him. So, anyway, Steve was very, very impressive to me in how well he understood the philosophy of life and how well he was able to orient himself. I think he must have been a very capable leader. I think he was able to
absolutely
get the understanding of the role that he needed to play in the business. And I think he was willing to be hard on himself and on people. I speculate that he was not easy to work for or with.
No, but I think I'm sure he probably wasn't. I mean, I know that he would do these talks, these presentations, like when they were announcing the latest iPhone or iPad or whatever.
Right.
And he would practice 50 hours for basically a 2 or 3 hour talk.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So that really is, you know, being very professional.
Well, he knew just how important that was. But yet this has been drummed into me before, too. It's you invest an hour for every minute, at least if you're doing an important presentation, and a day for every minute if you're doing a do or die kind of presentation. if I were doing one of those launches, I'd rehearse madly for a long time myself.
Yeah.
But anyway, I want to just go back to this, to the points you made, very, very important and valid, which is, number one, the money is not the issue. We can point at dozens and dozens of very well-off people who die of conditions that they had no business dying of. Most recent in the pancreatic cancer was Patrick Swayze. The thyroid cancer of George Harrison and I think it's Michael Douglas who's dying of it now.
Right.
What else do we have out there? I remember Paul McCartney's wife, Linda. She died of breast cancer. I mean, Linda her previous name was Eastman Kodak, or Eastman of the Kodak family. So there was no money problem there.
No.
There was a consciousness and understanding problem. I could understand, or I'm speculating now, but Steve Jobs, with his technology orientation in his life, would probably be inclined to seek technological answers to his health problem.
Right.
Which the pharmaceutical model is a technological model. So let's start at the beginning. How about some prevention? How is it that the pancreas gets stressed in the body? Pancreas squirts out sodium bicarbonate and pancreatic enzymes into the small intestine when something comes out of the stomach. Normally, it should be the chyme, the ball of food that has been sitting in the stomach for a while and it's been kneading in there and mixing with enzymes and mixing with acids, and it's quite acidic and it's just flowing out into the small intestine ready for the actual digestion. So at that point, the pancreas should squirt the sodium bicarbonate in there to alkalize it and enzymes to make processing possible. Well, if that person has had a coffee or something of that sort before their meal, the pancreas will just squirt whatever it has to alkalize the acidic drink. Again, I don't know if Steve was drinking coffee before his meals, but he gave the impression that he might have.
Well, the chances are most of us do, right?
Well, many people do. I haven't had a cup of coffee since 1972.
But would you say that you are considered in the mean or average of the population that we're talking about?
Definitely not.
No. Say, me too. I mean, I haven't had a cup of coffee in 30 years. Don't like the taste of it. Don't like what it does to me and everything else. But everywhere I turn around, there are lineups at Starbucks.
Yes. So let's just say that you start your morning with a cup of coffee as your first drink. Well, it goes in your stomach. The first thing the stomach does with it is go, ooh, what is this? Dumps it on out. The pancreas is, holy smokes, acid event. Psh, hit it with all the alkalizing power we have. And then you go ahead and eat something else. Well, when that arrives, the pancreas has already spent its wad, so to speak.
Good and, way to put it.
And now it's asked to try hard. So it just musters all its reserves and tries to hit it. So you're overloading your pancreas and you're treating it badly. So that could be one of the reasons how it gets into trouble. But even then, on our website, you know, I have a side website that I've built specifically for cancers. It's called Cancer Healing, cancer-healing.com. And on it, among other things, I have published the very long article about William Donald Kelly. That's K-E-L-L-E-Y. He was the forefather of the modern metabolic typing, the metabolic understanding of the human physiology. He was the first guy that we know for sure that understood that biological individuality is what dictates how you should treat a specific person. Anyway, Kelly, I think it was 1960 or 62, as a 42-year-old young dentist, was given the death diagnosis of pancreatic cancer. Most people with pancreatic cancer don't last more than 3 to 5 months after the diagnosis. Anyway, Kelly was committed to trying just about anything, and did. And for himself, he discovered that if he used pancreatic enzymes by the shovelful and changed his diet dramatically towards raw food and essentially vegan, vegetarian, low-fat, high vegetables, high fruits, he lived. He lived a very long life. And he was teaching people how to heal themselves. But he had a really interesting surprise come his way sometime later in his life, when his wife got very ill, and he tried to treat her the same way as he treated himself. And she got sicker and sicker and sicker. And finally, just, she was unable to sit up in a hospital bed. That's how weak she got. The only thing that was left that he didn't try feeding her was meat. So he made some beef broth, brought it to her, and started feeding it to her. She got stronger, and she got better. And of course, then she could eat more varied foods. And she did get out of that hospital bed and lived a long time. And that's when Kelly discovered that one-size-fits-all nutritional approach doesn't work. But what we know that does work is the approach that feeds the body healthy, nutrition-rich, enzyme-rich, mineral-rich foods. And the modern pharmaceutical-based medicine doesn't do any of it. Scott, you've gone awfully quiet.
I'm just fascinated by what you're saying. I've just been listening to it, and I found the page that you're referring to, so I'm making sure we have it in our podcast.
Yeah, it's awfully long, but it's fascinating.
It is, absolutely. And
anyway, so had Steve Jobs, how do you pronounce it correctly?
Jobs.
Yeah. Had he perhaps discovered it? Because he was a maverick and he was a lateral thinker. He was able to think outside of the box. Had he gotten to this before he committed himself to the technological medicine, he might have had a chance. But instead, first he had this pancreatic treatment. There was some sort of an operation done on him, and that was to save him. Later, he had a liver transplant and radiation therapy that was done on him somewhere in Switzerland. Just the word transplant. You know, if you transplant somebody, you have to put them on a immunosuppressant drugs. Well, when we speak to cancer afflicted people, we tell them, well, you need to upregulate your immune system so it can deal with the rogue bad cells. Anyway.
Actually, when you were talking about that, I was thinking, you know, if you have a small tree growing and you dig it out and you transplant it to another part of the garden, and because it's not doing very well where it is, and you stick it in another part that has basically the same fauna, soil, mm-hmm. The chances are it's not going to do any different.
Yes. Yeah, that's a very good point, is if you transplant a healthy liver into a sick body, you're just going to have a... this is complex. I mean, another issue for me... that's not even addressed here is what happens when you bring into the body somebody else's organ. How does that actually change you? because I know that every organ is a seat of a whole bunch of stored memories, emotional, I don't know what you'd call them, recordings of events and of opinions and thoughts we hold. This is documented. People get heart transplant and all of a sudden they have loved classical music all their life, but they have started exploring acid rock or vice versa. So I don't know what that means for him, but I'm sure that his life was somehow changed by the import of somebody else's organ into his body. And that actually had me thinking, well, what happens when you transplant blood, when you do a blood transfusion? How much of what's in the blood of a person goes into the bag, and how much of that consciousness comes in? I, of course, have no way of measuring it, but I think that it may be quite significant.
That's an interesting point.
So I'd be... maybe we all should have our own blood banks. Maybe we should all somewhere, especially if we know that we are going to go in for an operation. We should prepare for it for like 3 or 4 months in advance and set aside 5-6 pints of blood to be ready so that we get our own instead of somebody's.
Well, the blood, the DNA in your blood is different than the DNA in my blood, right?
Well, there are these blood types which we need to worry about. But I'm just thinking that, you asked the right question. I'm not answering it. I don't know to what detail the differences must be there. Mm-hmm. But yes, there must be a different DNA. I mean, my fingerprint looks different from yours.
And the blood cells, they replicate and divide, and the reason they do that is through their DNA. So if you've got someone else's DNA running through your blood, then it's going to be different.
Yes.
Of course, better than being dead. But
right, precisely. I'm just thinking.
But those are questions that we never really ask, right? Like what are the ramifications? Like when you go into one of my pet peeves, going into a hospital, turn off your cell phones because it interferes with the delicate equipment. Hello? What about the delicate equipment between your ears?
Yes.
So, anyway, I don't want to get into that. But you bring up some good points about...
Yeah. Anyway, so I was just trying to say how sad I am because, you know, in the next 20 years that he would have probably still worked. Steve might have dramatically changed the culture or the world or whatever with his ideas. I don't think he was the inventor of the products that Apple put out, but he certainly was directing the engineering teams and what they chose and what features went in and so on. I speculate that he had a strong hand in that.
Yep. He was also one of the founders of Pixar.
Yes, important.
Yeah, so I mean there was...
Toy Story, right?
Yeah, great creativity.
The first computer-generated animated movie.
Yeah, and a blockbuster, so...
He made a bundle on that, too.
Yeah, no, that's for sure. But you could see he's very creative. He brought a lot of outside-the-box thinking to things that he did, and he was quite amazing, and it's going to be—he's going to be missed.
Oh yes, terrible. And still, so okay, what would he have accomplished in the next 20 years? Well, miss that. Could I have made a phone call to him back in 2004 and say, Steve, I got stuff. I believe that I think differently than the mainstream, and you should listen to me and people like me. We see the world different, and we believe that we can help you. Would he have listened?
I think if you'd have said, the mainstream medical establishment is like Microsoft, and I'm like Apple in the 1970s and 80s, he might have.
He might have heard it, huh?
Might have.
Yeah, might have. Well,
although the problem, of course, is you have gatekeepers, right?
Right, yeah, you don't get past that. yeah, I could maybe try. But I don't even know to make that phone call. By the time his struggle is public, it's already too late. He has had an operation and this and that. Just to tell you, for instance, in my own family, my wife's brother's son, I mean, that's a nephew to me, right?
Yeah.
20-something-year-old guy has had Crohn's disease for a long time. And he goes to school studying some engineering disciplines, and he's completely not into this alternative health stuff, alternative anything. I mean, he's as square as it gets. And anyway, he just recently had an operation because part of his bowel became so scarred with the inflammation that it was causing blockages. So they operated on him, took out part of the bowel, sewed him back up, and sent him home, and so told him, well, go ahead, eat anything you want.
Wonderful.
Hello. So within a week, he was back in the hospital with partial blockage, with significant complication. Doing a second operation within 1 week, that's not funny.
No.
So they took another portion of his small intestine, and again, sent him off with zero instructions about nutrition or anything. In fact, his physician's opinion is that nutrition has nothing to do with the illness that he's experiencing.
Wow.
So when you go to a website about Crohn's disease, you will find that the magical formula which says, and we do not know what's causing it. You can find that same line on fibromyalgia, lupus, lupus erythematosus, rheumatoid arthritis, vitiligo, and who knows what else. Long list of other illnesses. Same line. We don't know what causes it. That's the official line. Are you kidding me? If you don't know what's causing it, why are you even treating it?
Right.
It's like taking my car into a mechanic and he says, I'm going to swap the spark plugs. And you say, why? Well, I think it's a good idea. I said, but the complaint that I came with was wheels. He says, well, we don't know what's causing the wheels problem, so we'll just change the spark plugs, okay? I mean, it's a totally logical answer, isn't it?
Yeah.
Anyway, they don't know what's causing it, but they're treating it. Okay, I understand. You need to do something. You have to try and do something because you're the guy with a stethoscope around your neck and somebody came to you looking for help and you have to do something.
Huh.
I think that's one of the biggest problems that we have in our system of how we've organized not just the medical system but the whole society. We have these people in position of authority that are asked to do something, to fix something, to make it better. And whether they have a clue or not, they just try. I guess that's why they call the medicine the practice. They practice medicine. Sort of same way as I practice piano.
Yeah. So you had mentioned, I think we've sort of... Beat Steve Jobs to death.
Please don't say it.
But you had mentioned there was another topic you wanted to speak on today.
I did? Oh, I totally forgot. Oh, yes, I know what I wanted to speak on. I have been noticing that the whole society is starting to come to a boil. You know, I was watching, I was warming up some food. And I set the some water in the pot and one of those things that hold it up to steam something. What is it called? A steamer? That's the word for it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, anyway, I set it up and I was waiting for it to come to boil. And you see your first few bubbles and then more bubbles and all of a sudden, and it starts going pretty good. And I'm watching this thing happening at... various cities in America, you know, people marching on Wall Street. And it started about 20 days ago as we're recording this today. Just a few people showed up there with placards and cardboard things. And look, there are now massive demonstrations in almost every major city with people wanting to take control back. It's not even well articulated. I don't see any strong, unified articulation of what they want.
Occupy Wall Street's what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and it's spreading to San Francisco and LA.
Philadelphia. And
even Vancouver is organizing a group.
Right. Essentially, it's discontent.
Mm-hmm.
Remember we talked about the Vancouver riot back in, when was that?
June? Spring, yeah.
And I think it's just tip of the iceberg. I think that the next generation, you know, the 20-something-year-olds, they're really unhappy.
I got an
email from somebody, you know, and as part of the series that we send out, one of the emails is focusing directly at baby boomers. As in, myself as one of the baby boomers talking to another baby boomer, I'm letting you know that we have problems and here's what you can do about it. Anyway, this voice from out there, a fellow, Thomas, hello, if you're listening, writes to me and says, I'm just mad at you people. You have exploited everything. You despoiled the nature. You have polluted the rivers. You have wrecked the fields. This is your generation. You were handed all the good things by the previous generation. You messed everything up. You flower children. You just turned beautiful things into crap. And I'm so mad at you. So I wrote back to him with, that was a great rant. Now listen, why don't you take this energy you directed toward me and join this discontent movement and toss the fat cats out. Change it. Make it yours. Make the world better. Go for it. So he wrote back and he said, you know, that's a great thought. Sorry for unloading on you. But the point was, right, take all this beautiful energy you have bottled up in you and do something constructive. And that's what I'm really worried about right now, is that a lot of these thoughts that are coming forward from there are quite destructive. I'm thinking teenagers, you know, 13-year-olds, emotional stuck at 13-year-olds, they're really capable of saying no or this sucks, but they don't have a clue what to replace it with or how they think it should be. And so I'm hoping that some intelligent people will step forward and start shaping and directing it. And my hope is that it will be directed towards requesting direct democracy, as opposed to parliamentary democracy or representative democracy. In a representative democracy system, you once every so often, like every 4 years, go to an election and elect somebody who's asking you to pick him so that he can represent you.
But in today's society, we don't really need that, do we?
No, we have the technology now. We have the Facebook, and we have the American Idol, and we have the Twitter, and whatever. We can make a decision in 3 days if we need to make a decision fast.
Yep.
So yes, we have the technology. We can change the world. Well, here's what it means. One of the things I watched Dylan Ratigan on CNBC, I think it's called, MSNBC, something like that. And he's saying, we need to get money out of politics. And I'm thinking, yeah, you're right. Because right now, the way the system is set up is that a corporation or any other interest can figure out how to influence the people who are going to vote on and influence the decisions that will determine the terrain or the just the environment in which you'll be operating. I mean, I've seen it happen in the healthcare industry. We, for instance, in Canada, we already have this full strength. In the United States, it's just coming in. The regulatory environment is becoming stronger and stronger under the disguise of protecting the consumer from the dangerous things. They are starting to put requirements on foods and vitamins and supplements that are currently applying to drugs. If you look at the statistics, you know, 20,000 people die of aspirin every year. In the last 10 years, there were four deaths that were attributed to supplements. And I'm not sure if it wasn't from taking too many and choking on it. But regardless, people don't die or don't have significant complications from these supplements, and yet the regulatory environment is marching very strongly towards imposing the regulations that are required for poisons, like drugs, onto foods and supplements. And it's a very different formula that's needed, because if you sell a drug for $100, that's a typical thing, prescription drugs selling for $100, the cost to manufacture that is probably $1.50 or $2 at most. When we make a supplement and sell it for $100, our manufacturing cost typically is $45 to $50 on that. Can you see the difference?
Yeah, it's a huge difference.
It's a logarithmic, exponential difference. It's not just that it's a little bit more expensive. If you really do the 2 to 100 is 50-fold, and 50 to 100 is 2-fold. So they have 25 times more power costs to retail. That's why they can afford these billion-dollar budgets for advertising on television, or these multi-million-dollar budgets for taking the thing through the authorization process.
Yeah, and they make it very, very difficult for... well, when you think about it, if you're just creating a chemical, then you create all these chemicals, particularly out of, say, petroleum, and you just use them in different ways. They give certain results, and sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad, and...
But it's easy to make it consistent. Like when say, right. I take a chemical, like a simple chemical like ammonia, or something small, more complex even as, say, sodium ascorbate, I can make that. That's fairly dead, and it's fairly easy to define what that is. And I can say, okay, sodium ascorbate 97.5% pure with non-toxic impurities. Easy. But if I give you an apple... it will have something like, I don't know, speculating now, 10,000 different ingredients.
And an apple from one tree may be quite a bit different than an apple from another tree.
Exactly. What soil was it grown in? What was the sunlight? What was the watering regime while it was growing? Blah, blah, blah. Every sort of a thing will go into that.
Yeah. Did you have a frost earlier than normal?
Yes.
Was it a dry summer or a wet summer?
Yes, all that. What soil? What insects? What this? What that?
And if you make an organic, if you compost,
yes.
And
what have you composted?
What have you composted? Right, and you know what? I happened to have a day where I was making lots of juice, so I got lots of carrot stuff and beet stuff, and that's going into my compost. And then,
okay, where did the carrots grow? Where did they come from?
Where did they come from? Right.
Yeah.
Much easier if you just make a certain chemical and then mix it up and hand it to people.
Right. However, that's the difference between life and death as far as the perspective goes. We're back to Steve Jobs. He took the technological approach, and it failed him. And it fails everyone, because life is based on a dynamic balance, not on a static balance. We have had this conversation in the past. The difference between static balance and dynamic balance, remember?
Yes.
Life is based on dynamic balance. It's based on uncertainty. It's based on exercising against resistance. it's based on inhale, exhale, you know, expand and contract. You cannot stay static. You must be dynamic. If you go static, you're a marble statue.
Nobody really wants that.
Well, it's really permanent.
Yeah, you never have to worry about those abs not looking good.
They will look good forever.
Well, Martin, I think on that note, we should wrap up today's show.
Okay, folks, I would like to, if you contemplate cancer, take a look at our website called cancer-healing.com. If you're contemplating just getting help with whatever else you have on your mind, give us a call. We're at 1-866-543-3388. Or come to the website, life-enthusiast.com. We really appreciate your feedback. Don't get enough of it. And we want to get more of it. So communicate. This is Martin for Scott and I, restoring vitality to you and to the planet. Thank you.